Welcome to the Visual Impact Podcast, bringing you conversations and insights from the world of filmmaking. I'm Rob Newton, and today we are talking to cinematographer Tristan Oliver BSC about his successful career in stop frame animation. Tristan has worked on some of the most iconic stop frame animation films made in the past 25 years, including The Wrong Trousers, A Close Shave, Curse of the Were-Rabbit, Chicken Run, Fantastic Mr. Fox, Paranorman, and Isle of Dogs. Tristan, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
I looked at your career and you've worked on some of the most iconic stop frame animation films, I think, made over the last 25 years. Absolutely brilliant. And obviously with the who's who of that genre, you know, with Aardman, Wes Anderson and Leica. But I believe it could have all been very different because you wanted to be a doctor when you were at school. Is that right?
Well, yes and no. I think, you know, as a small boy, I probably said that's what I wanted to be when I was 5 or 6 years old, and everyone just jumped on it, and you're sort of put on a train that then leads to middle class glory. But I knew pretty much by the time I was 16 or 17 that it was a job for which I was singularly unsuited. So I then had to sort of steer my ship in a different direction, and you know, like many people, I had a very inspirational teacher in my sixth form at school who sort of said to me, you know, this is idiotic. Why are you doing this? You need to do this. Yeah. And he taught me A-level English and theatre studies during my lunch hour, actually. And so I ended up sort of taking 5 A-levels, physics, biology, chemistry, English and theatre studies, and eventually went off and pursued a more artistic career, which is what I should have done in the first place. But I've always been very interested in medicine, and it's a sort of abiding hobby of mine. The history of medicine, I find it fascinating, but as a practitioner, I would have been a dud, I think.
Okay. So what led you to be a cinematographer? Was it something in your background in terms of what your parents did, or was it just out of the blue?
I mean, my parents were always very involved in the theatre. They were actually theatrical costume makers. So, I had a sort of performance background, and I had done some acting. And then when I was at university, I scored a part in a reasonably big movie. And I had never been on a film set in my life. But that process that went on around the camera, I found absolutely fascinating. And it was a sort of Damascene moment, really, where I sort of thought, yeah, maybe that's something I could do, because, you know, I had my scientific background, but, you know, I understood the physics and the technology of it. Sure. But I also had, you know, an artist's eye. And I thought this is something that it's kind of cool, you know, that group of people who shoot stuff, was very attractive, you know. I mean, as much as anything, it was, you know, the classic young man's response to something that you don't consider the practicalities of at all, but just think it's quite cool. So, I mean, that was my driving instinct. And then I had, when I was at university, there was a technician, who was called Dave Radet. And Dave Radet is a man with whom I co-shot a number of feature films. And I met Dave when I was 19. And he was the first person who put a camera in my hand and realized, he's about 8-9 years older than I am, and he realized quite early that I had quite a good eye, and he greatly encouraged that. And you know, to cut a long story short, we both ended up at Aardman working together on stuff and creating that whole look, really, which I'm sure is something we'll come to later in the discussion.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, because when you were I think you went to a Bristol Film School.
Yeah, I did my degree at Bristol, and then I went back a couple of years later and attended the film school, exactly.
Yeah, and you won the BPE, Kodak and Fuji Student Cinematographer Prizes.
I did, yes. The Kodak BPE prize was a prize that existed for about 3 years, I think. But it was very good because It was a fat check, which is something you very rarely get with student film competitions. So I think I got £1,000 check, which back then was a colossal sum of money.
And yes, I guess you usually just win sort of a bag to put your camera in or something normally.
Well, if that, you know, you get a cotton bag with the name of the festival printed on the outside and a memory stick these days, I think that's about it. so that was useful. And I sort of found out the names of the people who judged that competition. There were sort of five DPs who had judged that, and I got their contact numbers. It's all landline. It didn't have mobile phones in those days, or indeed computers. So I rang, I think I ended up with four numbers out of the six, and I rang four of them, and one of them said, "I didn't even vote for you." I thought it was dreadful, and I thought, oh my God, thanks a lot. A couple of the others were fairly non-committal, and then this very sweet guy called Patrick Duval, who's a DP who actually shot Distant Voices Still Lives. I went, and for a very brief time, I focus pulled for him, camera assisted for him. And I'm convinced drove him absolutely nuts because I was very, very poor focus puller. There were a couple of shots that even now haunt me. And whenever, you know, whenever I'm on set and people sort of talk about things that happened when you came up through the business,
yeah,
I always tell this story of following this woman riding a horse on a very long lens as she rode towards camera and missing the focus over and over again, and the horse getting more and more tired as the damn thing pelted down the field towards us. So I was a very, very poor focus puller, which actually is a really good thing, because if you're a very good focus puller, it's very hard to get out of it because no one will let you. So. Yeah.
Yes, because it's a very underrated, you know, not within the industry, but outside the industry, people looking in, I think that's an underrated craft, isn't it? Because a lot of people say, well, how difficult could that be? Just keep it in focus.
You know? Yeah. Well, it's not just that. I mean, yes, that is an astonishing ability to be able to gauge by eye something that's coming towards you. But they're also, you know, all over the equipment. They're essentially, they look after all the gear. They're responsible for the, you know, checking all the gear in the rental houses there. You know, if you have a good relationship with a focus puller, then you are constantly in conversation with them about choices of lenses, choices of cameras, you know, choices of other people on the crew. You know, they're the linchpin of a good crew. They really are.
Yeah. And you went to the Moscow Film School as well?
Yes, that was part of the BP prize, actually. It's a very short trip to the Moscow Film School, but very, very interesting. It was at a time when Boris Yeltsin actually was still mayor of Moscow. So it was before the wall came down, just before the Berlin Wall came down. And the place was in absolute chaos because people had suddenly realized that they didn't have to do as they were told anymore. So it was absolutely chaotic. People were flouting every kind of regulation you could imagine, you know, driving down the wrong side of the road. People were building things that were falling down before they'd finish them. You know, it was astonishing. And this venerable film institution, you know, which had sort of nurtured Eisenstein and Tarkovsky and people like that, you know, was in a similar state, you know. And actually the Russian students who previously, had they missed a day, would have been expelled from the school, regardless of illness or extenuating circumstances. You know, they were failing to turn up. So it was just the international students who were there because they'd always run an international program. Yep. But it was conducted in the most archaic way. You know, sort of remember this woman being wheeled in a wheelchair and this long black coat with a tall stick, and she's sort of standing up and shouting acting classes at us, and a highly formulaic way of treating the way the camera moved. You know, you would have classes such as the approach to the woman sitting at the dressing table ending in over the shoulder with two reflections, you know. And you would do this as a handheld exercise over and over again with these cameras that weighed the same as a small car. And it was very, very formulaic. You know, they couldn't,
yep,
they didn't quite have that sense of breaking out and doing what you liked. And I'll rather, you know, I mean, really, really very scrappy student films that we've made in the UK, which we screened for them, they were all over them saying how fantastic they were. And purely because we didn't really know what we were doing. And so they were organic, to be kind, but a bit scrappy, to be honest. And so within this very formulaic environment, they saw something attractive in that. Anyway, I wasn't there for very long, but it was an experience. It was great. And when I came back, I just did those things that everyone does, really, which is sort of made pop premieres with mates and did short films and things like that, and sort of tried to get on and up. It was very, very difficult at the time because the union, the ACTT, was very, very strong, and it had become ludicrous. You know, you couldn't work unless you had a ticket, but you couldn't get a ticket unless you were working. So, I mean, part of my reason for going to Bristol was that it was an accredited course. So I did have an ACTT card when I came out, but it was still super difficult to make that transition. Yeah.
And during that time or since, have you got any cinematographers that sort of inspired you on the way or mentors?
Well, many. Certainly in terms of, you know, beautiful things on the screen. There are many cinematographers out there. You know, I think it's not always given to a cinematographer to make a beautiful film. It's quite often taken away from them because the constraints of budget, the demands of a director who may not be working to your advantage are such that being gifted the opportunity to make something beautiful is quite rare. You know, I think, you know, certainly a lot of those earlier cinematographers had it easier, actually. Sure. But now it's very much a sort of producer director thing, which is why so many sort of stick with their director, you know, because once you've formed that relationship, it, you know, it is easier to make that. But certainly people alive now, I mean, there are obviously Roger Deakins, Seamus McGarvey. I mean, I think Seamus's work on Atonement was absolutely astonishing. You know, I think it's just beautiful, beautiful film. And Roger's work consistently good. A lot of his work with the Coen brothers, Shawshank Redemption and Hearts Like a Proxy, for instance, are fantastic pieces of work, you know, and we can all learn from it. But I think I think the business is at an absolute high at the moment. I mean, when you just look at the quality of cinematography in television series, It's overwhelming. It's never something you question. You never see a television series and think this looks like a heap of rubbish. I mean, the Handmaid's Tale is it's beautiful Renaissance quality piece of work. You know, you can't but admire those guys, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, with Handmaid's Tale, I often think you can turn the volume down almost and just admire the images almost as still images.
Absolutely, you know, and it's super simple as well. You know, that sort of that key, that soft key through the window, very little fill light, and that encroaching close-up style on Elizabeth's face. Which is actually on a 28mm lens, which is a very wide lens. So the camera is super close to her, you know, and she's emoting straight into the glass almost, you know, it's like having someone breathing on you. It's a beautiful piece of work.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, how would you describe your approach as a cinematographer then? I mean, you're talking about, different looks. Is it, there's always a balance, I guess, between some people are very technical and some people are very creative, and some people are somewhere in between, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, doing what I do, which is niche to say the least, you know, what we were trying to do, what Dave and I were trying to do 20 years ago, was to bend this very unconsidered niche of the film business, stop frame animation, which was really just a kids TV medium, you know, and it was... The consideration of how it was shot was never paramount. You know, it was just, they would just put up a big soft light and get the Bolex out and shoot it. And we would all admire Trumpton or, you know, Magic Roundabout, all of which are fantastic, you know, seminal pieces of children's television. But what we wanted to do was, within the confines of what we had, was to create something cinematic. And, you know, and we, within a very short space of time, I mean, really within 5 years, we created a cinematic way of shooting stop frame animation, so that, you know, my instinct now when I step onto a set is never to think, today I am shooting animation. I am just going in to shoot stuff that happens to be small and will be shot a frame at a time rather than 24 frames at a time. But the actual, you know, nothing should compromise what you're trying to do in terms of the photography. And you should not be making any concession for the fact that it's animated. So, you know, I would say that my style is generally as naturalistic as I can make it, because I'm always struggling against the hyper unreal constraints of working at scale. And also the designs tend to be very quirky, you know, asymmetrical, very sort of comic book in many instances. And so you don't want to go wacky with your camera work and lighting. You actually want to make people believe that this is a real place where stuff looks a bit weird. So, you know, I mean, a super simple example of that is, you know, if you're shooting a daylight exterior, you know, there's one light. There's a sun. That's what there is in real life. And so why should you be trying to do that any differently? You know, why should your characters be projecting two shadows onto the ground? Because that immediately gives away the fact that you're looking at a model. Yep. So, you know, this process of learning how to light daylight exteriors, which although simple, actually took some doing, you know, because actually what you need is an extremely big light. You need the biggest light you can get, because You can't put it at infinity like the sun. So if you use a small light, all your shadows run off like this.
Yeah.
You know, they diverge, as this is audio. Your shadows diverge, but you want your shadows parallel. And so the bigger the lens you have on the light, the more parallel your shadows are. And so, you know, you learn to work with fixtures which are putting out far more light than you need, but are actually the nature of the light is what you need.
Sure. So when you started off, did you make a conscious decision to do stop frame animation, or was that something that you got into and then it just progressed because you were very good at it?
Yes. No, I mean, I don't think anyone should make a conscious decision to do it. I mean, it's an absolutely ludicrous way to make a living. I had envisaged for myself a lifetime of shooting commercials and feature films with humans in. And it didn't work out that way. And it didn't work out that way because I rang Aardman one day to borrow some lights for a pop promo, because I knew Dave. Dave was at Aardman. And Aardman then was four people, working out of a garage. And they said, yeah, sure, you can borrow these lights. You know, we were all mates, did each other favors. And they said, what are you doing next week? And I said, well, I'm not really doing anything. And they said, well, do you want to come in and finish off a commercial? And I said, yeah, that'd be great. So I sort of ran down to Bristol, and, you know, there I was, 25 years old, shooting 35 millimeter commercial for them. You know, they were so sort of laid back in their working practices in those days that they would take on a job and they would absolutely no idea how long it would take to shoot. And so they were constantly losing crew. They would kind of go, oh, I've got to go and work on, you know, Doctor Who next week or whatever. So, you know, and so that's why I got to finish the commercial, because someone else had gone off to another booking that was more accurately scheduled. Sure. So, and I, you know, and they had so much work coming in. I mean, we were literally in a garage with black curtains up, and quite often we'd be shooting four commercials at once, each of which was in a space the size of the average living room, you know, and work was pouring into that place because they were very exciting with what they were doing. And I just kept getting work, and I had also had a child very young. So I had this little baby when I was 26, and I did need to knuckle down and get some income. So the fact that this work just kept coming in meant that I kept going back. And, you know, before I knew it, I was, you know, I was there at the right time, because they were in launch mode, if you like. And they went from four people up to about 20 people in the first year I was there. And then very quickly were expanding out of that building. And by 1992, I think I first started working for them in 1989, and by 1992 we were setting up for Wrong Trousers. So that was, you know, that was a massive change, you know, going from big mouthed comedy animals doing commercials up to a half hour special for the BBC, which was all shot on 35 millimeter and was actually the most expensive half hour of television the BBC had ever commissioned. And when I tell you now that I think it was £450,000, you'll realize how little money the BBC spent in those days.
Okay. I mean, looking at the differences between stop frame and live action, can you give people an idea of, in terms of the lighting and the depth of field challenges that you have doing stop frame?
Yeah. I mean, to go back to my original point, you know, there shouldn't be a difference, but there are some technical constraints, and the biggest technical constraint is depth of field, because you're normally working with a character that's around 20 centimeters, 8 inches high. And therefore, you know, if you're doing a mid shot or a close up, it's pretty much by the lens. So you're working at the minimum focus on a lens, or you're using a macro lens. So the character is very, very close to the glass. And this throws up two problems. One is the camera's in the way of the animator and the light, because the camera relative to the character you're shooting is about the size of a removal van. A 35 millimeter camera is anyway, about the size of a removal van. So you have to learn how to light around the camera. But the biggest problem is depth of field, because all your normal lens maths goes out the window when you're that close to the camera. So, you know, if you're shooting a human head, you're doing a close up, you can happily get that close up 4 or 5 feet from the camera. And even if you're wide open, the eye will be in focus, the ear will be in focus, the end of the nose will be in focus. If you're on a longer lens, you might even have focus back to the horizon. But with a model close up to the camera, in order to get that look, in order for the eye to be in focus and the ear to be in focus, the lens needs to be at 11 or 16. And you need to be working with a wide lens, so that ameliorates your depth of field issues as well. So, you know, Wes Anderson is very fond of using very wide lenses, which kind of helps this. But, you know, on other films I've done, on Aardman and Leica, you know, we use the full box of lenses. So you will typically take a close-up on a 55 or a 42-millimeter lens, and it will be at 16. And you'll be lucky to get the ear in focus. So you really have to, you know, you just learn different ways of working. But of course, what you have, because you're only working a frame at a time, is you've got infinite control over your shutter speed. So, you know, the camera is not aggressively running at 24 frames a second and limiting your exposure to, you know, normally a 48th of a second or, you know, whatever. But so I can work at a shutter speed of 6 seconds if I need to. I don't often like to, but I can if I want to go to that kind of shutter speed in order to get that stop down.
Yeah. And is it DSLR type cameras now, Canon type cameras, or are you still shooting with video?
No, we've never shot with video, continuous video. We shot with 35 millimeter movie cameras that were adapted to take a frame, single frame. Right. And then we transitioned immediately to digital stills cameras. The reason being that the quality of the image is so much better. You're trying to single frame capture from a video camera the quality isn't as good, but also if you're using a production video camera, it's insanely expensive because, you know, we run on a feature, I'll run 50 plus units. So I kind of have 50 Alexas in the building because, we couldn't afford to buy them. We also couldn't afford to rent them for 2 years. So it's, you know, the economics of it are prohibitive. But what a digital stills camera gives you is it gives you raw data, which is infinitely more of it than you're getting off even pretty high end cameras now. I mean, I get the Red Monstro might give you 8K, but you know, I'm getting easily 6 to 8K off a Canon DSLR. And we used to, you know, we went into this Fantastic Mr. Fox. We were using Nikon D3s, which is a beautiful camera. But Nikon, we stopped using Nikon cameras because the live view wasn't particularly high quality in those days. So there was a sort of period of about 10 years when we used various iterations of the Canon 5D.
Yeah.
Mark 1, 2, and 3. But the Canon 5D is not a great camera for animation. It suffers greatly from temperature fluctuations. So if the studio is hot, it will produce a different image from if the studio is cold. And so when you've got days where you come into the studio in the morning and it's 18 degrees and by lunchtime 5 degrees, you're not taking the same pictures you were first thing in the morning. And so there's an awful lot of post-processing in order to pull that image back. And if you want to get on with animating in the morning, you know, your cold camera doesn't look like the hot camera at the end of the previous day. And so you're then into ludicrous measures like actually pointing lights at the camera in order to get it to heat up. So they're a bit of a nightmare, actually. So when we went, when I did Isle of Dogs, we tested a lot of cameras. I think we tested eight cameras, a couple of Sonys, a couple of Nikons, some Canons, Panasonic. And the 1DX, which was then the Mark One, Canon, was an infinitely superior camera. And although it was much more expensive than the 5D, what we saved in terms of post-production fixing more than made up for that. And because we have a relationship with Canon, you know, we were able to get them at a considerable discount. And they also loaned us 15 cameras. So that was a much better camera, much more stable under temperature. I mean, again, they do have issues. They're not designed to shoot animation. They're designed to shoot people scoring goals and the Queen. You know, they're a press camera. So they're never designed to shoot sequential images that match in terms of stability, color temperature, you know, contrast, whatever. But they do, and they do it very well, and they produce a chunky, great file, which is very useful. And also because they're full frame, we can shoot widescreen. We can shoot 2.39 with spherical lenses. So, you know, all kinds of things are brought to advantage by these cameras. But every time we do a feature, we have to find another one.
Yeah, sure. And I'm assuming that, I mean, what is the average time that it takes to shoot one of these movies?
I mean, soup to nuts, it's normally 2 years. The actual shooting period is between 16 and 18 months. So I will go on maybe 4 months, 5 months ahead of shooting, do my camera testing, establish a relationship with the art department. You know, everything in front of the camera is made.
Yep.
It's made by hand, by someone. And so an awful lot of testing goes into texture, paint, you know, magnification. How does this thing that looks beautiful in your hand look when it's projected 30 feet wide? So, you know, I have to establish that relationship with the art director, with the production designer. That's what it takes. I mean, Chicken Run took 72 weeks to shoot on 35 millimeter film. And that was the quickest. That film took off like a rocket. It was an astonishing experience. It never faltered. Since then, I don't think I've ever shot one that quickly. It's normally about 80, 84 weeks, something like that.
So that's a big commitment from, well, everyone's behalf, but certainly for you. So I guess you have to really make sure that when you choose a project, that's really, you know, what you want to spend 2 years doing, as opposed to being stuck on a project that is not what you really wanted. So do you have a list of what you need to, that would attract you to say yes to a project? Do you have a list of criteria that's it's got to have a good script, obviously, and the house style?
Yeah. I mean, I think these days I can be a bit more choosy. I mean, there have been periods in my life where I've taken what's been there and I've been lucky in as much as it has been successful. You know, the way of these films is that they tend to attract the very limited talent that there is, but that, you know, there are a lot of talented people on them. They tend, because of the nature of them, to have global release. So I know from the get-go that it's going to be seen in a lot of countries and a lot of languages, and it's going to have a reasonably good budget. I think anything that has a too small a budget, I automatically bridle at a bit, because I know it will be a struggle and it may not get finished. And that often happens with European co-productions. So, you know, you end up with a film in Portuguese that is only seen by the Brazilians and the Portuguese and is never quite finished properly. So, I mean, that is the kind of thing I tend to avoid. So I tend to go for English language, US financed movies. And the script is absolutely paramount. You know, they don't come along very often, these movies. I mean, at the moment, it's this unprecedented number happening, you know, I think three. normally there's only one, maybe two. So the script is paramount. When I got the script for Isle of Dogs, Wes sent me the script and the first 12 minutes of the animatic of the storyboard. It was tremendous, you know. It was a rollicking good read. Sometimes you get a script, and I'm a firm believer in, if you can start a script and end a script without moving, it's very good. If you need to have a cup of tea, it's lacking something. If you need a cup of tea and a wee, then it's probably not quite as good. You know, anything, and if you're looking at what page you're on, it's probably not good.
How many pages left to go?
Yeah, you know, and you get a lot of stuff in script form that you know, they want to know whether you're interested, and you can just say yes because you know it's absolutely not a prayer of being made ever, and it will just vanish.
Let's move on to your early career at Aardman, where you worked on Academy Award winners The Wrong Trousers, A Close Shave, and Curse of the Were-Rabbit, as well as the popular feature film Chicken Run. Did you have a favourite, or is that a bit of an unfair question?
Of the Aardman films, mm-hmm. I think The Wrong Trousers was the most fun, because they're a very small crew. There are only six of us on that, unbelievably. And every day was exciting. We used to run to the cutting room every morning and look at what we shot the day before. And it was a constant process of being excited and having a lot of fun. You know, we were all reasonably young and enthusiastic, and there was a sense that we were creating something that was going to be very, very good. And that's, you know, I've been excited by other projects, but there was just something about the sort of newness of it. And, you know, you could feel almost from the word go that it was a quality product. And you know, with bigger projects, you don't always know until it's finished how good or bad it is, because there's so many people involved, you know, and there's so much of it is sort of taken away and stuff is done to it when you're not looking. Whereas we're very much in control of that whole process.
And what was Nick Park like when you first started, you know, to work with? Was he someone who liked to be hands-on in terms of the set and that sort of stuff?
Oh, yeah, no, he was animating on Wrong Trousers. I mean, he was, he and Steve Box were the two main animators on that movie. So on a daily basis, he was in there twiddling the plasticine. And it was his movie. I mean, he already had an Academy Award for Creature Comforts at that point. So, you know, he was an established, you know, people knew about him. In fact, he was nominated twice in the same year for Grand Day Out and Creature Comforts. People knew him. But it's just, you know, as I'm sure you know, he's a very nice guy. You know, he's quiet. But he has a very good sense of what works in front of the camera. And the great thing about Wrong Trousers is it's very, very shot light. I mean, I think there's only about 135 shots in the entire half hour, which is very, very low. And the ability to just let the camera sit and watch is something he's very good at. Mm-hmm. And I think after that, you know, the more successful you become, the more other people become involved in your process, and therefore it becomes harder and harder to keep that simplicity, you know, because people demand more action, probably wrongly. But the great thing about Wrong Trousers is, of all those films, you can watch it with the sound off, and you can watch it in any language. And I've watched it in Finnish, and it's just as good. As soon as you go to the next movie, Close Shave, a lot of the plotting is tied together with signage and written stuff. So you need to be able to read. You need to be able to read English, or at least you need to be able to read subtitles. So that immediately removes it from a layer of people, certainly removes it from people sort of under five. Who are going, "Mummy, what does that say?" You know, or "Daddy, why is the dog doing that?" You know, so that level of complexity was not to its detriment, because again, you know, won an Academy Award, Close Shave, you know, and it's a very good film, but it has a certain loss of innocence, if you like, at that point.
Sure. So how would you say the house style changed then as Aardman became more successful, more, you know, a bigger operation, as you say, more people and more staff? Did it get very more segmented, or did the excitement that you initially had still keep bubbling?
Well, certainly the excitement bubbled into the production of Chicken Run, because what a lot of us wanted to do was to make a feature film, you know, and we were sort of champing at the bit, really, to get something of that scale. And it was very, very exciting to have that opportunity, not only just to make the feature film, but actually to have the money, to have the investment to be able to buy the stuff that would enable us to achieve some of the things we wanted to do for a long time. And, you know, on Wrong Trousers, we had one magic arm and one screw gun, and we had to check them in and out with the producer. You know, we were so under-equipped on that, and we were using cameras not all the time, but some of the time. If there was a commercial shooting, we had to give up our decent cameras, and we were using cameras that had been designed to go under the wings of bombers to shoot reconnaissance in the war. I'm not joking. I mean, this is really, you know, barrel scraping with equipment. So we suddenly had this opportunity to invest in some pretty good equipment, and Chicken Run was a super exciting you know, it was like being in an airplane taking off for the entire process of the production, and it came in under schedule, which is unheard of. But to your point, it did result in something of a schism between the Aardman purists and those of us who wanted to make big movies, because there was a sort of feeling that they had lost their purity, that the sort of cottage industry artisan feel of what they were doing had been somewhat compromised. Whereas for me, it felt like a logical next step. And in fact, a lot of what they wanted to maintain, those who thought something had been lost, wasn't appropriate for the big screen. And that very heavily handmade feel to the puppets, for instance, the fact that you could see the thumbprints all over them, just wasn't translating to the big screen, because a thumbprint on a face at 20 feet high is not charming at all. It just looks, it looks unfinished. And so I know that after Chicken Run, there was a lot of sort of soul searching as to whether they should go back to something that was more like the Wrong Trousers in terms of that thumminess. And a lot of people were very keen on it, but when they shot tests and projected them, it was obvious that was a non-starter, you know, and things do need polish. And we spent a long time wondering what it was that would justify the larger size of canvas that we were being required to work on. You know, and what makes a cinema film rather than a TV special?
Yeah.
And so, you know, that a lot of things factor into that, you know, set design, camera movement, you know, that we spent a lot of money on motion control for Chicken Run, which paid dividends. You know, the ability to move the camera naturally through space just gives you that sense of scale and size. And so, yeah, for me, it was a step forward, but I know for a lot of people, it felt like betrayal. But you can't, you know, if you want to make another movie, then the movie you're making has to be commercial. You know, you can't pretend that movies can be made for too little money for the discerning few.
Yes. I mean, you touched on it earlier on, but could you just expand a little bit on the logistics of working on a large number of multiple sets?
Well, all those films have been multiple set films, and they've got bigger and bigger as time has gone on. The biggest one I did was Paranorman, where I had 56 shooting units. You don't hit the ground at 56. You hit the ground at about 4, and then it grows and grows and grows. And obviously, since I left Aardman, I've helmed these productions on my own. So Aardman very much teams up directors and teams up DPs, so there's always sort of two people doing everything. I needed to doing my own thing. So it grows and it becomes not only a cinematic exercise, but it becomes a sort of management exercise, if you like. So when I've got a studio with 50 odd shooting units in it, you know, each of which is probably from a different bit of the movie. There's no very little continuity running. It's just what's ready. You know, I have to have a top down view of what each of those units is doing. And I will personally, like with my gaffer, I'm probably running about 15 to 18 of those sets. And then I have a couple of other guys who have been with me for years and years and years who light as well. And at the beginning of any new sequence coming onto the studio floor, I will sit with them and we will discuss exactly what is needed stylistically, how they're going to do it. And then they will show me. They'll show me the tests they're shooting, and I will give them feedback and notes on that, because that movie has to look like one hand made it, and that's my hand. So I can't have people going off doing their own thing, no matter how beautiful that might be, because it will stick out like a sore thumb. So I need people who know that that's how I work, and in that way, you know, we arrive at a coherent look and feel for the movie. But it does start to take over everything. Certainly when I was in Portland, when I woke up in the morning, I would be ticking off in my head, you know, as I had my shower or my muesli, I would be ticking off in my head what I had to do in the first hour of the day. And then I would meet with my first assistant camera, my focus puller, and we would have a cup of coffee and we would go through together what was needed. And we would say we would have rushes at about 7:45, and then we hit the studio floor, go into edit. And then at 11, I'd have my meeting with my first AC. And then we'd be back onto the studio floor. And then I'd have a meeting with the VFX, you know, so all through the day, we were making sure that we knew what was happening at any one point. And of course, any schedule changes on an hourly basis, because you only need one animator to have a problem or one bit of kit to go wrong. And that particular line of the schedule has slipped a bit. But because you have a critical mass, you know, you can afford for a few units to be underperforming or going wrong because you've got 50 others rocking up. But it is, yeah, it's enormously consuming. But I kind of love it, actually. I do love a big feature film. I feel sort of energized by the process. And anyone who knows me will think this is an extraordinary statement, because I normally get quite ratty at some point during the process. But just that feeling of being in control of something that big is actually quite exciting, and I do enjoy it. I miss it when I'm not doing it.
Right, and of course, then you moved on to shooting The Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Yeah.
Did you think that at the time it was the right time in your career or your progress to leave Aardman at that point? Was it something that you were looking to do?
I mean, the thing is, I was never on staff at Aardman. So I was a freelancer, and I did always work for other people, especially in commercials. So I would go off and I would do commercials for companies in London, and I lived in London. I used to commute to Bristol weekly. And I did short films for other people, which were, you know, successful. So I always had another life outside. And at the end of Curse of the Were-Rabbit, for reasons which I still have no explanation for, the phone stopped ringing from Aardman. And so I was left Aardmanless, which at the time both puzzled and annoyed me, but actually was entirely the best thing that ever happened, because I was then able to go out and do stuff with other people. And so what has happened at Aardman, I think they would be the first people to agree with me on this, is they got into a bit of a rut stylistically, and have ended up, certainly until very recently, rehashing a lot of their old tropes and styles, in the belief that that's what people still want. But in actual fact, that has been proved untrue. But yeah, so I rattled around for about 14 months after Curse of the Were-Rabbit with very little work. And then I got wind of the fact that Fantastic Mr. Fox was coming down the pike, and I actively attempted to get hired on that job. You know, I went to the producer and said, I want to do this. And she took my reel and showed Wes, and I got the job. I mean, it's as simple as that. And what I didn't know at that time, which I consequently found out, much to my eternal shame, is that they had actually already appointed someone. And I kind of usurped them, but I didn't actually know that that's what I was doing, but it's quite embarrassing when that comes to light.
And was it very different working, you know, with Wes compared to Aardman?
Yeah, everything about it was different. It was different because what you have at Aardman is a studio that even, you know, by the time we'd done Curse of the Were-Rabbit had been going for 15 years. And so they have the real estate, they have the equipment, they have the people, they have the, you know, the company mentality, and they have a brand which everyone works to. So, you know, you walk onto the stage and you know exactly where everything is. So those films that were made at Three Mills Studios, which started with Corpse Bride, which I didn't work on, and then we did Fantastic Mr. Fox, and then Frankenweenie, which I didn't work on, and then we did Isle of Dogs. So those four stop frame movies that were shot at Three Mills were standalone entities. So that was a process of going into an empty warehouse and turning it into a usable animation studio and trying to recruit people from all over the world, multinational crew. You know, we had people from Venezuela, we had people from Japan, we had people from Africa, you know, just drawing these people together in London for one movie and then going, thanks very much, off you go. See, at Aardman, that never happened. It was just continuity. They rolled from project to project and there was always something else going on, whether it was a short or a commercial. That thing of Aardman-ness was continuous. So there was that. There was the setting up of the studio from nothing. And then there was a director who had never done stop frame before and really had no idea what it was about, and therefore was asking for whatever they wanted, which to an extent drove us all absolutely potty, because, you know, there are things you just can't do in stop frame, but Wes doesn't take no for an answer. And so we got to the end of Fantastic Mr. Fox, all rather sort of battered and bruised by the process. But he was right, you know, and that film is incredibly popular and people love it. And then when, you know, everyone kind of went, oh God, I'm never working with that man again. And then when the call came for Isle of Dogs, to those of us that it came to, we all went, yeah, okay, we'll do it. And Isle of Dogs was infinitely, not nicer, but infinitely sort of smoother process, because the thing about Wes is what he wants is he doesn't want the bother of having to relearn a group of people. You know, he needs to say, this is my guy who does this. This is my guy who does this. Yeah. And I have no interest in them not being available. I need them here to make this film. So Bob Yeoman shoots all Wes's live action films. Tristan Oliver shoots all Wes's stop motion films. And we have a language and we have a relationship now, which is incredibly affectionate and friendly. And, you know, we go out to dinner together. It's completely different from Fox. But without Fox, we wouldn't have that.
Yeah.
The Fox was that sort of learning curve, you know.
Sure. And just moving on to, I think it's one of your favorites, which is Paranorman. Great movie. I watched it again last week, actually, just as a refresher. But it's got that really nice balance between a bit scary, but not too scary for the kids, you know. And it certainly looks astonishing. I know this might sound strange, but possibly not. But if you look at Norman's sister and her earring kept glinting all the way through. And it's just little touches like that and the various pans. It really is, you know, I really like it. So obviously they then moved from Aardman to Wes and obviously now to Leica. So again, was that very similar or again, was it completely different the way you worked and the way that the thing was set up?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I am inordinately proud of that movie. I mean, I think cinematically, it's the best thing I've ever shot, and the reasons for that I will come to. I was contacted by Leica through Claire Jennings, who had produced Curse of the Were-Rabbit, so I knew Claire, and I'd also done a short film with her called The Weatherman, and we'd become firm friends on Curse of the Were-Rabbit. And she was then hired by Leica to go and sort out a lot of production issues they had on Coraline. So she was kind of bedded in at Leica. And in her brief tenure there, she hired in Sam Fell, who was a director I knew from Aardman, who I'd worked with many times over the years, who I liked tremendously. And they had a young director there called Chris Butler, who had written this movie called Paranorman, and they weren't sure whether they were going to go with Paranorman or with Box Trolls. They had them both in pre-production, and I just went over for a general chat to meet the directors of both those projects to see whether there was a fit there, and Chris Butler and I clicked immediately. I already knew Sam. Sam was keen to have me on board. And so I was hired for the job, cut a long story short. And I went in very early on that job. I was in probably 6 months before we started shooting, and there was a huge amount to do. But the funny thing is that studio, in terms of its layout, was made in the image of Aardman. It was, I think on Coraline, they'd had a number of people come over from Aardman to work on it. And you could just, you could almost walk through the door into that shooting space and know where everything was. It was very funny. And they had the same kit. You know, it was made in the Aardman image. And actually since then, that is how to set up a stop frame studio. And, you know, the Fox studio and the Isle of Dogs studio, they're all set up like that. You know, things are in a certain place and those are certain things that you need. And that's just how it works. You know, they'd spent 15 years finding that formula and everyone else has stolen it and it works extremely well. So I'd finished Fox not long before that, actually. I mean, I think it was only sort of 6 months between finishing Fox and going to see Leica. And I was able to sort of break free. Everything about working with Wes is about making a Wes Anderson film. You know, you don't make anything other than a Wes Anderson film. So everything about it is very, very prescribed. So the way he wants it framed, the way he wants it lit, the color of everything, you know. So he's very, very keen on having the very best people to achieve exactly what's in his head. And so that's one kind of director. Chris and Sam were very, very keen on my bringing to the table whatever I wanted to in order to make their film as good as it could be. And obviously they had a veto on that, but from the get-go we were on the same page. And so I was able to do things that I'd always wanted to do, and I had a huge amount of freedom in terms of photographing that movie. You know, I was doing things that you should never do in stop frame, because I always fundamentally believe they would work, and they did work. I was also shooting stereoscopically, and I was told on the day I first went to Leica that there was no way you could shoot widescreen stereoscopically and it would still work. And I thought, I bet there is a way you can do that. So that's shot 239 widescreen, that movie, and it works completely. And the reason it works is I was never particularly enamored with the whole stereoscopic thing anyway. I think it's a load of bollocks, to be honest. And I think, you know, you end up with a three-dimensional image that compromises on so many levels the beauty of what you've created in 2D. I always advise people to go and see the 2D version of Paranorman, which looks fabulous. And as soon as you convert it to 3D, all kinds of problems ensue with the contrast and the shadow detail and all kinds of things. Yeah. And it doesn't lend anything to the movie. And I hope that's a kind of evolutionary dead end now. I know Leica have clung to it, but I don't think people are interested in going to see 3D anymore. But anyway, so we shot this film in 3D, and I shot a lot of long lens stuff with quite shallow depth of field, and you know, I was just able to, you know, I used a lot of very high key light as well, very hard key to that movie, and I think a lot of that was a sort of palette cleansing exercise, having been stuck in the super flat, super symmetrical world of Wes Anderson for so long. It was great.
And how did you integrate the CG elements with the stop frame animation?
Yes, I mean, there is obviously CG in Paranorman. It's used quite sparingly, I think, but from the word go, we were very keen for that integration to be driven by the stop frame. So we didn't want it to look like CG, and a lot of the CG animation is the witch in the sky, you know, the skies and the witch in the sky. And so we wanted it to look as if it was made out of something real, and we experimented with a lot of things, and I did a lot of tests with sort of dry ice and various forms of fabric, and we arrived at a structure that we like made out of bridal veil, out of tulle. Mm-hmm. And so we took a huge amount of reference pictures of sort of scrunched up bridal veil and tulle. And then that was mapped into the computer and used as the source structure for all those clouds. So if you look at them, you can actually see that it looks like scrunched up bridal veil and the witch's face in the sky. Yeah. I've actually got a clip of the development of that image in CG, just going from simple wireframe up to the final image. And you can see all the way through that they've held on to the integrity of that. And then to double up on that, most of the backdrops in Paranorman are actually painted. They're proper scenic backdrops, which is such a delight to work with rather than bloody green screen all the time. So even the skies, the painted skies in the sort of back gardens of the kids and things, the clouds are painted with that lattice structure, with that net structure in them, so it mirrors what is then done in CG. Some of the, you know, other effects are just bog standard effects. I mean, you need Aggie exploding, you know, an awful lot of her is actually in camera. You know, her head, which morphs into a dozen different shapes and splits in two and screams, all that is printed, is 3D printed and actually part of the puppet. They're replacement heads. And it's just the electrical stuff coming off her that's being comped in as a CG effect. But yeah, I mean, they have a sizable CG department at Leica. And I think from that point forth, it then got, it played a very big part in what they did. I mean, certainly Kubo, I think, is probably the most successful manifestation of that. The problem is if you shoot in a way that throws your decision making process to the post production end of the movie, it's very easy to say we'll put a green screen in here and we'll decide on what that looks like later. But then at the end of the movie, you realize that you've done that 500 or 600 times. And that someone actually has to sit down and create those backgrounds and to create that environment. Whereas if a decision had been made, then everyone would be working to a style and the whole thing would be far more coherent and far more of a piece. So you really have to watch that. You know, you have to be in control. And I did. I had a couple of sort of physical face-offs with the head of VFX on Paranorman. I mean, not least because he was a very, very good friend of Peter Kazarchek, who had shot Coraline, and there was a sense that Pete had been ousted in order to make space for me to come in. But, I mean, Pete's a very nice but very different DP to me. He's more of a coordinator, whereas I put the gloves on and I get up the ladder because I need to know physically what the lights are up to. And that process of actually creating a beautiful image is what I do. I don't hire a group of people to do it for me.
There's a shot in the movie when Norman walks down the street and the camera swings around his head 180 degrees and then it follows him as he rises up and it reveals the town in the foreground. Yeah, could you just describe how that was shot?
Yes, well, that is nearly all in camera, actually, except for the deep image of the town beyond the rooftops. That is actually a digital matte painting. It's a piece of flat digital artwork. But the rest of that was done in camera, and it took a very, very long time to set up. We bought actually an enormous cruciform motion control rig. So if you can imagine, it had a sort of central pillar, very tall, narrow central pillar, and a sort of crossbeam. So it was cross-shaped, and the crossbeam went up and down and in and out relative to the central pillar. And it had a 21-foot reach on it, this beam. And we constructed a special camera head so that the camera could sit on the end of the beam, hanging down, so that we were able to perform that 180-degree pan around him. But wedded to that camera, which let's remember was only a 5D Mark II, was a Cook 5:1 Cine Zoom, which is a huge piece of glass. Mm. So we had to make an adapter to get that to fit on the camera, because the shot goes from wide to very, very tight on Norman's face. In fact, I think it goes to a kind of eyes and nose tight shot. So we needed the full extent of the zoom. So the problem here is it's a bright sunny day and you've got an enormous piece of metalwork moving in and out and round, which obviously drops a shadow somewhere that you're going to see. So the set was constructed with a row of houses either side, and it was lit so that it had a low morning sun, because it's part of a sequence called Norman's Walk to School. So it had a low morning sun, which meant that the houses on the left-hand side cast a shadow nearly the full width of the street. And within that shadow, we were able to hide the camera boom and the camera to reduce that problem as much as possible. But the programming of it was Byzantine, and the shooting of it was Byzantine, because it was very difficult for the animator to get to the puppet. So we constructed the street in one go with all the houses, all the dressing lit beautifully, and we shot the camera move without Norman in it. So that created a background plate, essentially a moving background plate. And then we stripped away the left-hand side of the street and we shot it again. And then we stripped away the right-hand side of the street and we shot it again. So by now we're down to the road surface, still without the puppet. And then we took the pavements away and we replaced the road surface with chroma key green. So that all that was left of the set was the road in green, and then we put Norman in. So the animator could get right up to the puppet without having to lean in, and, you know, could, because it's a nightmare. If an animator has to climb on and off a set, stuff moves, it's very, very awkward. So Norman was animated on his green street, and then he and his shadow were stripped off and put back into the environment. But the biggest problem was this rig with its huge sort of arm sticking out. And the arm was basically a girder. So it's very long and very narrow and steel. And it was the summer. And we would come in the morning and the camera would be as much as 3 or 4 inches off where it had been the previous evening because of the contraction of the steel. So nothing had moved in terms of the motion control rig, but just the length of the arm meant that the cooling had caused this thing to move. So we would wait for this damn thing to find its position, and people would be monitoring it. And as soon as it hit position, we would start shooting. Because, of course, if you left it too long, it just went back the other way. But yeah, that took up an enormous slice of the studio, that set, because it was very, very long. It was probably 50 feet long, that set, and about 18 feet wide. And in order to shoot it, coming back to this issue about how big your key light is, you know, we had to have this very, very big key light, which meant going, I found these fantastic, Mole Richardson still make these 10Ks inside the housings that they used to put arc lights in. It's called a bug-eyed 10, and the lens is enormous. I think it's like 30 inches, the lens on it. And that's exactly what you need, this beautiful big lens. So we got some of these Mole Richardson 10Ks, but because we were in America, you can't run a 10K in a standard studio because they only have 120 volts, and the current is far too high. So we had to wait for them to put a 240 volt supply in. And because it was so expensive, they only did it at one end of the studio. So that was always the end of the studio that we had 10Ks in. And everywhere else in the studio, the biggest we could run was a 5K. Seems extraordinary, I know, but that is the way. So that's why it takes twice as long to boil a kettle in the States. So we had the 240 volts put in, and we had these beautiful big bug-eyed 10s. And my colleague, James Lewis, who has been with me on Fox and Paranorman and Isle of Dogs, he's one of the guys who lights for me. He set that unit up, and he spent the months it took working out that move. He was buried in there every day, much to his credit.
Well, it certainly worked. It was a fantastic shot. It was almost like a Citizen Kane sort of move with, you know, like a tracking shot when they used to follow everyone around. And it is quite stunning. I love it. You have mentored students at the NFTS and other film schools around the world. Is that right?
I have done, yes. I'm currently doing some online teaching with cinematography students at the NFTS because, of course, we're all in lockdown. So the cinematography students are allotted an animation project each as part of their thing. So this works to everyone's advantage because they get to shoot a bit of stop frame, and the animators get to feel that they're wanted because they get decent cinematography students. And so about four or five of them every year are allotted a stop frame project. And I'm sort of helping them with that. And they're very enthusiastic about it, which is great because I thought they'd be a bit sniffy, but actually they are very enthusiastic, and they do listen. They're very good students in that respect, because I think they appreciate that. You know, what we've done is we have actually made this art form into something cinematic. So that's great. But prior to that, I was the mentor for a woman called Daisy Jacobs, who was an animation direction student at the National. And she got a BAFTA scholarship to do her MA. And as part of that, she was appointed a mentor, and that was me. And Daisy and I, this must be 6 or 7 years ago now, I was able to give her a huge amount of time, and I did a lot of input on that movie, everything from sort of the script and the storyboard through to the sound mix and the grading and the color, and I managed to get them some equipment, you know, loaned for them. And the guy who shot that for her, Max Williams, he then came to work for me on Isle of Dogs actually for a short time. So they're sort of looped together. But Daisy and I have stayed very close contact, and I helped her out with her second film. And she's now, she's got a feature in development with the BFI, live action feature. And I'm helping her with that. And hopefully if we come to that goes into production, then I will shoot that for her. So that's a great relationship. And she's still sort of emails me every day going, I've done this, what do you think, you know? So I'm a safe place you know, for comment, because she knows I won't lie to her, you know. I'm very upfront with her. And I've done various bits of guest lecturing around the world, you know. I've never been a sort of permanent staff member. I think once you get to that point, it kind of, you have to decide whether that's what you're going to do. You know, because it stops you doing other stuff, really. But yeah, I've done a lot of lectures and a lot of teaching, but never on a permanent basis.
I know, but it's good that you're actually giving that back to the industry, if you like, and to the up and coming cinematographers. So
Yeah, it's great actually, and I hear from people all the time. It's bizarre. I did a workshop, like it's just a 3-hour workshop at SCAD, which is the what does that stand for? It's in Georgia. It's College of Art and Design. I can't remember what the S stands for. Anyway, they're the biggest film school in the world, and they have a huge stop frame animation division. And I was just chatting to one of the girls there, and she was showing me some stuff, and she was doing some lighting for the animation course. And I've stayed in touch with her, and she's now interning at Leica. So I put her in touch with them, and she's gone to Leica and has been working there for the past year. So that's nice. And I occasionally get, you know, feedback from these kids who I've met for an hour or two who were still kind of asking me questions. So it's good. I like it. I greatly enjoy sort of going and telling people what I do, but I don't think I have it in me to construct a course and go on a regular basis to teach people things because it's not me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. No worries at all. Well, unfortunately, we need to wrap the podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, Tristan. It really has. Thanks for your time today on the Visual Impact Podcast.
You are very welcome.
That was cinematographer Tristan Oliver, BSc, talking about his work with Aardman, Wes Anderson and Leica. Thanks for listening. You can find more podcast blogs and exclusive Visual Impact content by going to our website, visuals.co.uk.